Invicte has been managed privately since its founding in 1805, meaning that our partners have dealt with the same challenges facing all entrepreneurs. Our owner-managers are themselves entrepreneurs who, like our clients, want to build an even stronger firm to pass on to the next generation. Over more than 200 years, we have built up experience and specialist wealth management expertise that puts us in an ideal position to offer independent advice. Entrepreneurial clients feel a deep connection with our partners as they can speak with them on the same level, business owner to business owner.
Frederick Carling is the CEO of Hovding, the Malmo-based company which makes what it calls the world's safest cycling helmet, except it doesn't make a helmet at all. Hovding is in fact the airbag for your head, which inflates from a collar worn around your neck should you be in an accident. Hovding registers a cyclist's movements 200 times per second, inflating in just under a tenth of a second, and is testing to be much safer than a traditional foam helmet. To date, Hovdings have protected more than 4,000 cyclists involved in accidents around the world. The idea for Hovding started back in 2005, when a new law was passed in Sweden making bicycle helmets mandatory for people younger than 15. In response, industrial design students Anna Haupt and Therese Alston started a project to create something cyclists who didn't want to wear a helmet might be okay with wearing. It took 7 years to turn Hovding into a certified product, at which point there was an opportunity to grow the company and brand around the world. After a career working for big fashion brands such as Levi's, Frederick Carling joined Hovding and has helped drive business and innovation for the growing company, which has just released the Hovding version 3. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bage. For today's episode, I sat down with Frederick to hear more about his story, the company's base in Malmo, and the incredible growth of Hovding.
I think one of the reasons I was recruited into Hovding was the fact that I came from a fashionable kind of retail background. I didn't take the academic route. I started in the warehouse of Levi Strauss when I was 18, and then I ended up spending 17 years with Levi Strauss, working internationally, launching quite a few sub-brands for Levi's internationally, globally. And I think that was also kind of the lead into Hovding, because the original idea of how to position it and how to sell it was very much as a fashion accessory.
And how do you think you came into this sort of entrepreneurial role in a startup? Was there something in your career, in your progression with Levi's, that was entrepreneurial at all? Were you sort of leading departments, or what sort of plays into it today and what you're doing?
One of the things that I enjoyed most in those 16, 17 years with Levi's was there was a time in end of the 90s where I was kind of handpicked together with 500 other individuals out of the business and was locked away in a room to reinvent the blue jean. Levi's is a large organization, and you kind of need to, in order to create something new, something different, you kind of need to pull people out of it. We were a group of, let's put it, entrepreneurs acting in a corporate world. And the result of that was a concept called Levi's Red, and eventually Levi's Engineered Jeans. Some knows of it as the Twisted Jean, Twisted Sidestream, etc. Having kind of worked in a very rigid corporate environment, having had that taste for what if you're allowed to do as you see fit, and what if there's no don'ts or buts and so forth. And I think when the opportunity of Hovding came along, is similar. It was a company, but at the same time, it wasn't a company. It hadn't been born in its kind of future form yet. It was a group of individuals and the founders who had this vision and idea, and everything was focused on making a product possible, but not necessarily kind of building a company. So having had the taste of acting with less boundaries, which I had within Levi's, this was for me is a great opportunity to kind of work in a more entrepreneurial way, not with a set history. Not this is the way we've always done things, but rather how can we do things? So I think that is maybe a tease for joining Hovding as well.
That's really interesting. And I want to come on to where you really got interested and where you were recruited to become part of this launch to get this product out in the world and out to the market. But let's perhaps go back and talk about how this was developed, sort of a conceptual piece, more of a fashion piece. Can you tell us that story?
The two founders, two design students out of Sweden, back in 2005, there was a discussion in Sweden whether adults should be forced to wear cycle helmets by law. And their frustration was, well, come on, the helmet industry hasn't moved for 30, 40 years. Why can you not design a product that people want to wear as opposed to enforce something on people that they really don't want to wear? So they started looking at what is it that people are really, at that time, I mean, 90% of adult cyclists, they did not wear head protection. So why didn't they? And one of the key reasons is that people don't want to wear something on their head, whether it's for vanity reasons, whether it makes them feel kind of locked in or whatever the reasons are, people do not want to wear something on their head. So the idea was then stolen from the automotive industry where you have protection you don't see, which is the airbag. They started working on this concept, which the industry and people around them just said it can't be done. You can't detect accidents. You can't read body movements like that. You can't develop an algorithm that works for that. You can't develop an airbag system that you wear that is not fixed in a car, for instance, etc. And it really triggered them into kind of making this impossible possible, if you like. They spent then 6 years in recruiting mathematicians, airbag engineers, project managers, raising funds to get it done because it was a costly project. And then eventually it got certified and approved and could start selling.
And is that where you came in? What was behind you coming along and being part of this journey?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, at that point, the company or the group of individuals was primarily product development experts in various fields. So there was very little commerciality in the business. And there was no international kind of experience. And everyone obviously saw this as an international or global potential. So they were then looking for someone who had that experience, could come in and help. While the product development kind of DNA needed to continue, needed kind of to add another layer on top, which was commercialism. That's my background, so that's why I was recruited in. And to help, it's not just hiring a sales rep or two. It's just not, okay, let's do, I don't know, a marketing campaign. The culture of the company really sits in the wall. So it needed to change in how we thought and how we acted to move from just a product development company to a commercial entity as well. That was the task that I was brought in to do. So today, the company really stands on those two legs. We're hugely commercial in many ways. At the same time, we're continuously developing product and try to push the envelope even further, of course.
How quickly was that transformation of the company in how it operated, how it looked, how it felt to work there? What was that?
Quite long.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. I mean, breaking point in the company was when the two founders left the company operationally. And obviously with that, there kind of came a point where the company moved into a second phase. And that was 2 years after I joined. Like I said, just not hiring a sales rep or two, you cannot underestimate for 5-6 years, the company had been developing and building a DNA, which you don't change overnight. So you have to respect that you can't go too fast because you alienate and you lose some of the really great things with what has been. But you can't go too slow either. You need to kind of progress and move forward.
So what was the target when you came on and wanted to get this out to market? What did that look like? What was the scale?
Millions and millions and millions, and everyone in the world. I mean, the ambition, and it still is to be a company with a product or products that is available everywhere in the world and to basically everyone who is cycling in an urban environment. And I think over time, one has developed a respect. If you want to do that in a long-lasting manner or in a qualitative way, you have to take it step by step. So right now, our ambition is to conquer Northern Europe. At the same time, our second biggest Facebook fan base is from the US. The third biggest visiting population on our homepage is from the US. And we get emails from Colombia and from Taiwan and from South Africa and from Canada, from everywhere. So the ambition is enormous, which it should be for a product like that. But you have to respect as well that it is a physical product, it is a safety product, and you can't rush it too. So we're kind of hurrying slowly, if that's an expression, I don't know.
Sure. And in Northern Europe, what's the sort of traction been like? How reticent have people been to take this up, to try this product? Because if you look around a lot of places now, in Amsterdam or Hamburg or places like this, people aren't wearing helmets, but maybe they're wearing Hovdings. I don't know. What's sort of the scale now?
It's interesting what you say, because when we ask, I mean, now there are 150,000 cyclists around Northern Europe who wear Hovding. So it's not just 1,000 or a couple of hundred. It's 150,000. And Hövding has been part in over 4,000 accidents in which it's done its job. And sometimes it's been really serious accidents. So it's kind of proven itself to some extent, gone beyond just, oh, it's something that kind of exists, but it doesn't exist. Mm. The interesting, back to kind of the founders, what they found when they started the company is that almost half of the users of Hövding, they have never worn a traditional helmet before. These are cyclists that then feel, okay, it's probably a good idea to protect my head, but the traditional design of helmets, I would never wear it for different reasons. And here then is a product where it kind of matches, I want to protect my head, and it's a design or it's a technology that I do want to wear. So we're kind of both addressing, if you look around London, for instance, or if you're in Hamburg or if you're in Stockholm, you would see people wearing traditional helmets. Those are people that are keen on wearing Hövding. But then you see the ones that are biking around completely unprotected, and they are equally keen on Hövding.
Would you say the target customer then are both those types of cyclists?
Definitely.
Or is it?
Yeah, definitely. And within those, I think it's really cool. It's few products have such diverse attraction. I mean, we have 18-year-old techie, innovation-interested girls who buy into Hövding because of the pure innovation and kind of advanced technology within it. Then you have this 76-year-old guy who recently just bought an e-bike and feels a little bit insecure on his bike and he wants the best protection in the world and everything in between. Or the 34-year-old guy who feel that he wants to be in front of innovation or where things are happening, maybe as a lifestyle kind of marker, he would buy Hövding as well. So it is an equally men, women, almost 50-50 split if we look at who is picking up the product today. So it's fantastic how there's so many angles in which you can come into the product. That's really cool.
I want to hear a little bit about how much the innovation has changed since that original product when you came on. But first, I think I need to get you to explain for a radio audience how this actually
how it works,
because it's billed on the website as the safest helmet in the world or safest piece of protection equipment, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's one of the challenges. I mean, we need to call it a bicycle helmet for people to understand what it's for, but it's anything like a traditional bicycle helmet. And obviously, we run our own certification and tests and so forth. But what we're really proud of, I guess, is that Independent Institutes has obviously gone through this product in great detail. Like Stanford University, for instance, they run a two-year project or review of looking for the best head protection possible. And they hailed Hövding or the airbag technology as 8 times better than traditional helmets. Or insurance companies that's tested it and said, well, this is a product which protects 3 times better against concussions and so forth. So it's a bit like Champions League and, I don't know, Division 5 or something. And the technology simply just gives that upside. And the way it works is obviously very complicated in detail, but simply you wear a collar around your neck. And once you activate that collar, then the sensor starts reading your movement as a cyclist. And it does that 200 times per second. And it reads acceleration differences, rotational differences of your bodily movement. And we've then trained it to understand the type of movement you as a cyclist do on the way into an accident versus just normal cycling. And we've done this by collecting thousands of accidents and thousands of hours of cycling to understand those movements. And then in event of an accident, the airbag goes off in 1/10 of a second, so 0.1 seconds, 100 milliseconds, it goes off. And it completely covers your head and stabilizes your neck and so forth. So it is, in a way, for someone who's listening, they have probably seen a car airbag inflate. It's not that different. At the same time, it's very different. Mm. The uniqueness in the product and the challenge in the product is both to get an airbag that is shaped around your head, because normally in the airbag industry, there's kind of cushions or quite straightforward designs. The second one is obviously to understand those bodily movements. Hmm.
You've had no failures. It works
all
the time.
It works. Now we've had more than 4,000 accidents. We've had a few where it has not detected an accident. None of them has been of any vital character. as we kind of progress the track record of how many are protected and potentially saved, you always have to realize that any product is not 100% foolproof.
If it does go off, you have to charge this caller, activate it, as you say, but then you can send it back and you're going to get another one. It's a small fee, but you're going to get it replaced, so there's no worry there.
It's a one-time product, and traditional helmets should also be a one-time product.
Sure.
So you send it back, or you go in our homepage and you look at how you disassemble it and put it to waste, so to speak, and that at a reduced cost, you take a new one. In some countries, Sweden, Denmark, the insurance companies, they cover it. So on your home insurance, you get a new one, for instance. In the UK or in Germany, you pay a small fee and then you get a new one.
You've already touched on it a little bit, that it's perhaps a really exciting time for cycling. I think a lot more people are taking it up. There's e-bikes. There's lots of options out there. More cities are really getting involved in this and in cycling. So it must be an exciting time for you and for the company as well.
For sure. I mean, if you look at some zeitgeist or macro-oriented trends, it's so much moving in favor of cycling, whether it's personal health or it's congestion in big cities or it's climate or financial, you know, personal finance. There's so many things that speaks for cycling. So it's just absolutely going through the roof. And with that comes the need to care for yourself when you're on a bike. I mean, you see in big cities now where the cities have great difficulties in kind of coping with this avalanche of increase in, you know, of cyclists. How do you build infrastructure that accommodates all these cyclists? And then you think about a cyclist as just one homogenous kind of, no, you have the ones who want to go really fast, maybe powered by electricity. Then you have those who are kind of slow riders. How do you get those to work together in the same bike lane and so forth? So cities have a big challenge with it. And with that, unfortunately, comes also accidents and the need for people to protect themselves. And for us then, it's both kind of a movement which we like, which is this shifting to cycling, if you like, but at the same time is also an opportunity because people, they need to protect themselves to an extent that they maybe didn't have to 10 years ago.
This may be a bit of a tangent, but I'm just curious, in your previous career in working with Levi's and blue jeans, and when that became a real thing again and you almost reinvented that it's cool to wear jeans, do you feel you're in a similar place now in this cycling industry where there is so much interest in this product and or different products in this industry?
I don't know if one can compare, of course. The energy is there, and you feel, and the energy in cycling is much bigger. The energy is from the political side, from all aspects of society where the energy is there. I think if I compare, I mean, I remember when I launched Levi's Red or Levi's Engineered Jeans back in 2000, and it was kind of hailed as the next blueprint and innovation kind of at the highest level and so forth. But it was still blue jeans. I'm very proud of it, and I'm happy having gone through that, but it's still blue jeans. In this case, with Hovding and airbag helmet, it is truly innovation. It's something which has never been seen even close to before. And it gives a lot of energy because it also pushes our colleagues in the business a bit forward. You see traditional helmet makers now, since a couple of years back, kind of taking up the challenge of how can they improve on, even though they still use the traditional technology, but how can they improve on that and how can they move things forward? So I think Hovding and one thing is obviously what we've done on our own and for the cyclists who buy into Hovding, but maybe also a tiny bit influence how the helmet industry on a whole is looking at what they need to do in order to stay ahead of things moving forward.
Well, that's interesting. And perhaps just lastly, we can look at what's next and what the focus is for Hovding, because as you said earlier, there wasn't a lot of change in this industry for a long, long time. And it seems that is happening now. And perhaps the big manufacturers and other companies are really saying, how can I get involved and or how can we do our next product? But what's the target for you? You mentioned insurance companies might be part of this, governments. What's the target to get more of these collars and bike helmets on people?
If we look at it in longer perspective, one could argue that, and I would be one of them, that Hovding is not a bicycle company. Hovding is an airbag or wearable airbag company, and there are different applications that one can think, whether it's people with poor balance, whether it's horseback riders, whether it's skiers, what activities, what people need some form of protection. So that's one kind of long-term route of the company. We sit on some patents and some technology that is quite unique. If we look within cycling, I think one interesting aspect which I'm quite keen on, if you look at the car industry, they've been very good for many, many years in kind of reactive protection. So in the case of an accident, how do you then, airbag comes out, seatbelt kind of, you know, gets strapped and so forth. they in recent years have tried to move into proactive safety. How can you predict an accident? How can you foresee? How can the motorists avoid the accident happening? And that's something that we're working on now. How can we move the reactive part, which is what we have already, how can we move that to the next level? But I'm very keen finding ways, how can we help cyclists avoid accidents? And part of that is working with cities as well. I mean, a couple of years ago in London, we launched a concept where we, with the help of cyclists, started mapping routes or intersections or areas which are more prone to accidents. And we took that deck of information and gave it to the mayor of London. Now in the next version that we're developing now and we're launching this fall, we're actually building that into the product. So as you're biking around with your Hovding, you have abnormal activity. It might be bumps in the road, might be hard braking, might be an accident. We're collecting that and actually can gather a never seen before kind of quality of the data that we can give to cities for them to plan better for cyclists moving forward. Our job is to help and support in any way we can, and then it's for others obviously to build that reality. There's some interesting things happening.
Frederick Carling there, CEO of Hovding. My thanks for Frederick for coming in to share his story. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs on Monocle 24 with me, Daniel Bache. Now, for the second part of our How Do I series to coincide with Monocle's brand new print title, The Entrepreneurs, we're looking at funding. For this, our Mary Sophie Schwartzer sat down with Pip Jameson, founder and CEO of The Dots, to learn about how to overcome the fear of starting a business and what it takes to secure funding. Pip launched The Dots in 2014, a professional network for people in the creative industry with the goal of taking on LinkedIn. Jameson raised £4 million in her second round of funding, closer to $5 million, but assures us that approaching VCs isn't the only way to go. But first, Marie asked Pip to explain exactly what The Dots is.
I wanted to create an alternative professional network that really worked for this community. And we call our community no-collar professionals. What on earth does that mean? These are creators, freelancers, entrepreneurs, people who are coming up with ideas and building teams around them to execute on those ideas. So I guess the big difference between how The Dots works and LinkedIn is instead of promoting yourself via a CV, our community promote projects they've worked on and then credit the full team around that project. I guess at the heart of everything we do is just help people make ideas happen. So our community uses us to find inspiration, but also to ask for help and collaborate and find work.
How did you approach funding, raising funding for The Dots?
Funding is a grueling process. It's tough for everyone. It can be particularly tough for women. Here in the UK, only 9% of angel funding goes to female founders. And at my level, because we raised a 4 million round, it's only 2.3%. It's hard for men, but particularly hard for women. I guess my biggest challenge when we did our first round is I had been in Australia and I just had no network. So I knew no one. I had to build that network from absolute scratch. And it was literally meeting after meeting after meeting. And everyone I met was like, can you introduce me to someone? And you're sort of slowly working your way up the ladder. And my break came that someone introduced me to this amazing man called Brent Hoberman, who started lastminute.com and made.com. And he loved what we were doing. And he introduced me to a number of my now shareholders, which is all my original shareholders. But it just was a lot of graft. Yes, just a lot of meetings and a lot of no's. And you just a thick skin.
You develop that over time. Yeah. But yeah, one of my questions was, how do you stay confident and motivated throughout the process?
Oh, gosh, I'm really lucky because I have a wonderful team. You know, they pick me up when I'm down. Every time I pitch also, I'd ask for feedback from whoever on the team was helping me. So they give me positive and negative feedback. But I think actually the great thing about getting negative feedback about how I was pitching, it helped me grow and be more confident for the next meeting. It's just really picking your investors and making sure they align with your values. Because, I mean, raising investment is basically like going into marriage, but without the benefit of makeup sex. You need to make sure your team's values are aligned, but also your values are aligned with your investors, because that can break a business too. What I love is the diversity in my investors as well. And actually, funnily enough, I call them shareholders, not investors. Mm-hmm. And it was a really great piece of advice someone once gave me. Said, don't call your investors investors, because then it's you and them. But if you call them shareholders, you're all in the same boat together. So my shareholder base is really diverse, which we celebrate diversity, so that would have to make sense. And funnily enough, also some of my best mentors are actually investors that turned me down on my last round. I've got some brilliant mentors who are like, well, you're not right for us yet, but you might be for the next round. And they actually help with different areas of my business now. So whenever I need advice with scaling or growth or tech, I can go to these people that actually turn me down, which is a strange relationship to be in. But it's really important for founders not to get upset when there's a no, because a no doesn't mean a no forever. And if you like that investor, keep in touch with them and check in with them, give them updates, ask their advice when you need it. And they might have turned you down for that last round, but the next round they might write a £20 million check. I have a very crazy vision to take on LinkedIn. There is just no way I can do that without taking on multiple rounds of investment and bigger rounds of VC investment. But not all businesses are like that. Tech is more like that, but not all businesses are like that. So I think the first thing you really have to ask yourself is, do you want to take on that money? Because the moment you do, you aren't in control of your business anymore. You have other people that you are accountable for. If you really need the money, then there's just lots of different options. So I went down the angel stroke institutional investment VC route, but there are lots of other avenues. And so I think my advice would be, make sure you research all those avenues, make sure what's right for you. If you're going down a route like mine, the VCs that are putting money into me, they're looking for me to build a $1 billion business, right? And that is a huge, scary thing. They either want a $1 billion business or they just don't care if you go out of business, right? That's the journey I have chosen. It's not right for everyone because I've kind of given up my life to do this, and I will for the next 10 years. So you have to really ask what you want from your life and then choose the investment vehicle that works for you. And sometimes a loan can work. You know, there's startup loans that exist that could work instead of taking on angel or VC. I think what I'm increasingly interested in is crowdfunding investment. So it was still quite in its infancy when we did our first round. I love the idea of raising part of the money from my community, and that my community actually benefit from any growth that we do. If I could be fully accountable to my community and not shareholders, that would be my dream. The thing that would slightly keep me up at night about that is I'd hate for my community, for anyone to put their life savings into the dots and something went wrong and I'd lose someone's life savings. So for me, I'm passionate about doing that for our next round, but I want to make sure there's definitely a sensible cap. That means no one's putting in more money than they can lose, because every business is risky.
What are the tips that you would give people?
I think number one is build a network, and build a network earlier than you think. It is easier now. There are wonderful networks like the Albright for Women or Angel Academy that can help you. Blooming Founders is another that can help you build those networks. But start building those relationships as early as possible. Build a portfolio of mentors that have done it and can advise you along the way. Funnily enough, as female founders, sometimes it's easier to get mentors that are men than women, because there's just not enough of us to go around. So for example, I get about 40 to 50 emails a day from women wanting me to mentor them, and I physically can't meet all those people. I used to really want female mentors as well, but I realized that they just don't have time. There isn't enough, you know, with only 2.3% of us getting to this level. So I changed tack, and a lot of my mentors are actually very successful men that have daughters.
It's a good compromise.
The ones that really genuinely are feminists and want to see things change. So I have an amazing portfolio of mentors who I can call on for advice. Like, is this term in this document, is this right or is it not? You know, who are the people I should be meeting? How should I? What are the metrics that I need to be hitting to raise that next round? And having that knowledge base around me is incredibly valuable. The third bit is just perseverance. Like, it is hard. It's so hard. And I think being an entrepreneur is so hard. It's so amazingly rewarding, but it is so hard. You have to deal with a lot of no's. So find a way to learn from those no's and not feel despondent from those no's. And I think that's the most important thing. And every no leads to a yes. And I'm living proof. If I can do it, anyone can do it. Literally anyone can do it.
Pip Jamieson, founder and CEO of The Dots, speaking to Monocle's Marie-Sophie Switzer. And remember, The Entrepreneurs, Our Business Handbook and new annual print title is on fine newsstands now. And that's it for today's show. My thanks to our studio manager, Maylee Evans, for mixing and editing this program. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.